everyone is basically in agreement that billionaires and celebrities are elites and like nothing else clears 50%.
And so this poll is like an overwhelming victory for the Bernie Sanders view that the elite is rich people.
Hi, I'm Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And welcome to The Argument. This week is a little different. We had really interesting new poll results come out. The Argument does original polling every month. This month, we decided to look into this question of elite perception. And that is like, you know, there's lots of discourse about what the elites think, what they're doing, anti-elites. Why are they messing up this country?
And we hate them, right?
We definitely.
Everyone is always against the elites.
Yes, the elites are bad, including other elites think that elites are bad. And that's very confusing for everyone. It got a lot of us internally thinking about this, about like, A, like who are the elite? What do regular people think that the elite think? Do they think elites are these like highfalutin college professors who have their crazy left-wing views about gender and race? Do they think elites are Bernie Sanders' kind of version of just billionaires and these rich tech billionaires that Elizabeth Warren is raging against? Like, who are the elites? This is obviously like one poll. You know, we have a really fun process where, you know, we've recruited polling experts across the ideological spectrum to review our poll language in advance to help us make sure that we're, you know, being rigorous, et cetera. But like, I do want to like caveat, this is like one poll and like, this is not something that has been extensively tested before. I think it surfaced like so many interesting results. So we're just going to talk about it today. But Matt, I'm going to put myself in the position of the pollster.
And I'm going to answer the poll.
You have gotten a ring from the Argument pollster, even though we do not do phone polls.
I'm hoping you're doing text surveys. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But we're pretending and for this purpose of the survey. So which of the following groups do you consider to be part of the elite? Business executives.
Definitely. That's my most elite.
Government employees.
Can I say like slightly? No.
No,
I'm,
you can't.
Okay, I'm thumbs down in government employees.
College professors.
Well, I'm going to give it a no.
Billionaires.
Sure.
Elected officials.
I say yes.
Journalists.
No.
Celebrities.
So I'm going to say yes to this, but I think that this is important because to me, like a celebrity is almost by definition elite. Like the way you would know that somebody is a celebrity in part is like that they are elite. And that when it comes to the college professors and the journalists, yeah. Like I think that there are individual people whose primary occupation is that they work at a university or they work for a media institution. Mm-hmm. But who, if you asked me, like, is Larry Summers part of the American elite? I would say yes. Right. And he's not a billionaire and he's not a business executive. He's not really a journalist, but he publishes columns all the time. He's not a government employee, though he has been in the past. He's a college professor, but it's like he's famous.
Yeah.
Ezra Klein is part of the elite. Mm-hmm. You and I, we're getting there, you know?
One day we'll join the ranks of the elite.
No, but it's like as journalists, our eliteness is a function of how well known we are.
I want to get into some of the results here, but I mean, I think that like actually this like question of like what this word means is difficult for people because someone's influence to me matters almost a lot more than their celebrity necessarily. Like, there are like people who are in government who have like incredibly influential roles over like the lives of like millions, if not billions of people who I would consider part of the elite, but like no, they're not household names. Like,
I agree. Listen, I mean, I'm trying to answer your poll, right? And it's like, no, because it's different. If you assign me like, Matt, like write an essay.
Yeah.
Explaining like, what does it mean to be part of the American elite?
Yeah.
Right. And I would say eliteness is an effort to capture an idea of influence. And so the reason business executives are the ones that I am least conflicted about is that like by definition, if you were the executive at a business, you are like exerting like leadership, decision-making authority over an institution that impacts people's lives. University administrators like aren't in your poll and aren't business executives, but they are elite for some of the same reason, right? Then you have to say though, well, within university administrators, obviously administering a big university is more influential than a small one, all else being equal. But I think we also understand that like Princeton is like a bigger deal than other universities that might be slightly larger, right?
Yeah.
How do we gloss that? it's a little hard to say, but like the greater famousness of Princeton is part of that, right? And so,
sure.
And so like celebrities in the elite, and it's like, you know, you can get into sort of borderline cases, right? Like who is a celebrity? You know, I don't act, when you get right down to it, like Anya Taylor-Joy probably does not actually exert a lot of influence over American society, even though she's fairly famous.
Yeah.
But movie stars who are like more famous than her maybe do.
So yeah, it leaves a spectrum, but let's get some results. Cause Matt, I mean, to be fair, to our audience, Matt has already seen the results of this poll.
I just wanted to loop back to the journalists and the college professors though. Right. Would you say that?
No, I just want to tell people the answers.
Okay. No. But okay. This is like why I'm hung up on the celebrity thing. Right. Which is that if you have Anya Taylor-Joy level of fame and it's not because you're in movies.
Yeah.
It's because you work for the New York Times.
Or you're an influencer. Or
yeah, yeah, but yeah. like a person like that would be very influential in America.
But I don't even know if that's, I mean, this is what I find like kind of confusing. Like there are these people who are super famous on like TikTok and whatever. And like, they're influencers in that like people will watch them do like get ready videos and talk about their lives or whatever. And maybe they'll buy some of the products that they're hawking or whatever. But like if this person told me to vote for someone, irrelevant. If this told me to like, person told me to like, you know, this is how I should think of, you know, dating or whatever. I'd be like, I don't care about your opinion. You have like quite literally zero influence over, like you're a attractive person that I will watch do a video. Seems like, what influence do you really have?
So I think that's wrong, right? I mean, I think an attractive, you know, a celebrity being like, you know what, Jerusalem, J.D. Vance has a lot of really smart ideas. That's not going to impact you at all.
Certainly not.
But on specific issues, right? Like, I think like Miss Rachel's decision to be engaged in the Israel-Palestine conflict is meaningful to people. That Taylor Swift's advocacy on behalf of LGBT issues was, you know, it's not super meaningful now, both because she kind of like shot her shot on it and also because those issues kind of settled into a fixed pattern.
Yeah.
But like shifting the conventional wisdom around what kinds of views it's like acceptable for a person in like what kind of demographic and cultural spaces to hold is very, very important. And like you can see like how upset conservatives are about aspects of the Odyssey that like there is a big and I think accurate sense that like what Christopher Nolan and Matt Damon and other like big influential people in Hollywood think like matters for setting the baseline of American culture.
I was surprised. I mean, to me, if you'd asked me in this poll, I mean, it's hard, obviously, because I've seen the results of it. So, you know, you have to take a grain of salt or whatever. But like celebrities as elites is obviously true. It's almost like even like a like it's like a common phrase, like the Hollywood elite. It's like just like a common thing to like hear about people. And like, you know, setting aside this whole spectrum thing about like if you like have a show on BET, is that the same thing as being like a movie star for a Christopher Nolan film, like whatever. But then like I actually think in some ways like the influence of celebrities is overrated here in politics. Like what did it matter that Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris? What did it matter that there were rumors that Beyonce was going to be at the DNC? Like was anyone I mean, again, like, I don't want to get too focused on, like, partisan politics here, but, like, those sorts of things, like, were, like, almost cases where you could, like, check, like, did people, like, would that affect someone's opinion about how and who to vote for? I think probably not, because it's almost, like, baked in that Hollywood elite are, like, liberals. But, like, yes, like, do filmmakers of popular movies affect the culture? Like, when Barbie came out, does that change or just reflect, like, where society is? I'm, like, increasingly more in like the reflect bucket in like our current media atmosphere. I think maybe things were different like a couple decades ago, but like right now, like Barbie to me as someone who's like maybe like too into like the feminism like kind of debates of the day, but like it felt like dated. Like even like the really popular feminist monologue that like, you know, real America Ferrera delivers in that film, like it felt like I was watching something that had been like written and was of the zeitgeist like 6 or 7 years back. My point there is just that like influence and elitism, I think, are actually not totally like overlapping concepts, both to people in our poll and I think just in how commonly that word is used. But we should take a break. But when we get back, we're going to give you guys actually the results of what people thought. Okay, now that we're back.
Okay, let me just run down the results. Okay, so in your sample, 77% say billionaires are elites.
Yeah.
60% say celebrities. 48% say business executives. 43% say elected officials. 25% say people making over $200,000 a year. And then it gets lower. 12% government employees. 12% college professors. 9% people with graduate or professional degrees. 9% journalists.
This is a good episode to watch because we'll put this on the screen for folks. But basically, the only majorities the country is in agreement on is billionaires and celebrities. Nothing else clears 50%.
Yeah, I'm just going to have like an old person, you know, moment here. But so in the write-up that Lakshya did for you guys, he sort of counterposes two theories of the elite. One is like the Bernie Sanders view that the elite is rich people.
Yeah.
And the other is a view that he attributes to Chris Rufo, which is that the elite is like university professors and, mm-hmm. and college graduates. And so this poll was like an overwhelming victory for like the left populist interpretation of the elite.
Yeah.
My recollection of an earlier era of discourse is that the right wing, as you were saying, would put a lot of stock in the Hollywood elite.
Yeah.
Right. And that they would counterpose the elite as not as down and dirty in this, like, we're going to micromanage federal grant programs, but this idea of celebrities, in which this is why I was leaning so hard on the idea of like famous journalists and famous professors, because I think the right-wing counterview that has the most traction with the public is that there's this kind of murky stew of famous people.
Yeah.
Who, you know, are in a little bit of like a self-congratulatory circuit of like award shows, right? And like sometimes it's the Oscars and like it's just Hollywood people, but documentary filmmakers also get up at the Oscars. And sometimes like it's the Pulitzer Prize, you know, and it's like more obscure writers and celebrities, but that there's this circuit of fame and that it's very left-leaning and that it's specifically left-leaning on cultural issues.
Yeah.
You know, and that it hops on these bandwagons, whether it's Black Lives Mattering or, you know, whatever else, and that this cultural elite is like important in America. And it is true that like Chris Rufo has tried to like programmatize this and literalize it in a way that I think people have not really bought. But it is also true that celebrities as elites like outpoll business executives.
Yeah. But I mean, I find this like a little bit hard because like business executives, like you could imagine this being like, you know, Tim Cook, but it also could be like the owner of a small company in your town. It's like, I think it's like not, I could imagine that those things would be mixed for people. And when you look at business executives at, you know, we look at the crosstabs, right? College educated people, 57% of them say that business executives are elite and just 43% of non-college. So that uh-huh. indicates to me maybe like the types of business executives that were evoked by this question would have driven this answer a bit here. The other big gap is between Trump and Harris voters. 57% of Harris voters said that business executives were elite and just 40% of Trump voters did. That's a 17-point gap.
Right.
And Trump voters and non-voters seem similar. So again, like what kinds of business executives are you thinking about? Like I would imagine that maybe like non-voters, non-college educated voters are imagining a more like mainstream version of a business executive than like the high powered CEOs that maybe were evoked for you.
Well, I mean, I think there's like two questions about this, right? That would be fascinating to see in further polling. I mean, one thing that has been occurring to me is my totally uninformed guess is that most people, particularly most left-wing people, overstate the correlation between being the executive of an important company and being a billionaire.
Yeah.
Because like it happens to be the case at this specific point in time that like Elon Musk is both the richest person in America and also is the CEO of companies that Elon Musk founded.
Yeah.
But like Jeff Bezos is very, very rich and is no longer the CEO of Amazon.
Yeah.
Now, he still, because he owns so much Amazon stock, has a kind of like embedded ability to control what Amazon does. Mm-hmm. But he's like a retired playboy, you know, who sort of happens to be famous. Bill Gates has not been operationally involved with Microsoft for a very long time. He is not as rich as he used to be because he has transferred so much money to his foundation, but he like exerts a lot of influence and stuff through that. A lot of billionaires, like the rich, we live in the DC area, and the richest people in greater Washington are just heirs to the Mars candy fortune. And I don't want to say they're not elite, like these are multi-billionaires, but they are not the business decision makers whose like thoughts and feelings and ideas shape the economy of greater Washington. And also, if you're like envisioning, you know, the workers banding together to fight for a better pay or whatever, like they're not, it's like not who they're, that's not where the practical conflict lies. You know, something I think we all know about public opinion is that if you ask people about stuff that they haven't thought a lot about, they'll give you answers that don't necessarily make a ton of sense.
Well,
and I think like most people have not spent a lot of time like scrutinizing the Forbes, the Bloomberg Billionaires Index and the Fortune 500 list and like seeing how well these things line up.
I mean, I think one thing that we were concerned about that with our poll, because again, like, this is not something that's been polled a lot. The consistency across categories, I shouted out a couple of areas of divergence across college, non-college, et cetera. But like in general, across categories, you don't see a lot of divergence. Like almost like everyone is basically in agreement that billionaires and celebrities are elite. But I mean, like, I think that kind of like consistency should give you like some level of confidence in this. But I want to underscore two things here. Like, one, you kind of glanced at this, but there is this like big effort amongst the right to categorize like almost like a cultural revolution style version of elite to be people with graduate degrees, people who work in government. I mean, that was kind of like a lot of the ethos behind Doge. People who are college professors, journalists, the media. And like, it's just like not flying. Like, at least again, in this poll, only 9% of people would even say that people with graduate professional degrees are elites. They don't think journalists are. They don't think college professors are. They don't think government employees are. None of that is true. And like, you might think like, okay, like, well, did people think elite was necessarily negative? The other big part of our poll was asking people about their perceptions of elite views. So like, what do you think elites think about a variety of things? And time and again, like the big pattern you see in our poll is that people have view X. We ask them what they think a majority of Americans think, and they think the majority of Americans agree with me. And then you ask them, what do you think elites think? And they think elites think whatever the opposite is. They think something fucking insane and horrible. They're picture of elites is not super consistent. They will assign both very left-wing and very right-wing views to elites. But what is pretty consistent across the poll is that they will assign the opposite view that they hold. And so what that tells me is that like people have a negative view of what it means to be an elite. They're not like, oh wow, billionaires and celebrities, love them, so elite. They're like, billionaires and celebrities, these people are elites, and they have views that are diametrically opposed to both me and the majority of Americans. And I find that like, I don't know. I find that like super interesting. I think
It's actually really funny because I think here's the place where I think these poll results most go against the conventional wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that I think there's a view among left of center politics gabbers that there's a kind of a populist construct in America that is left wing on economics, potentially very left wing, and like right wing on culture, like possibly very right wing.
Yeah.
But like in the poll, 71% of respondents say that they support free trade agreements.
Yes.
But their perception is that elites are much more skeptical of free trade agreements. They say that it's overwhelming opposition to government ownership of most businesses, but a perception that a large minority of the elite favors this.
Yes.
Then conversely, like, people attribute to elites a sexist view about men and women's suitability for leadership.
Yeah.
Right. So people say that they think most people think men and women are equally suited to leadership, but that most elites disagree with that.
Yeah.
Which, again, if you look at the characterization of elites as sort of rich business decision makers and celebrities, and it's like, well, you know, like most of the people in those positions are men.
Mm-hmm.
right? And like, clearly, if like America's Fortune 500 board chairs like wanted women to be CEOs of companies, there would be more women CEOs of companies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is one where like, in some ways, I think people are being more clear-sighted than the discourse, right? Like whatever is happening in corporate America, mm-hmm. like clearly the people in charge, like in their, they would never say it. I don't think you could find a CEO, maybe Elon Musk in public would say,
yeah,
I think on average, women are less suited to leadership positions.
Yeah.
But like, that's what they are doing, right? With their decision-making authority. Now, they could give you some stories about why it came out that way, but we can see what's happening there. So that I think is fascinating. Then the one issue where the public is like populist on an economic question is that 66% of people say there should be government-provided insurance for all Americans, mm-hmm. and they say that elites don't agree with that.
Yeah.
So like that particular question like perfectly fits like a Bernie Sanders narrative. Like we can come together across party lines to create government provided health insurance for all Americans, which is what most people want, but it is opposed by the elite. Yeah. Like on that question, yes. But like like the mass public wants to undercut your wages with NAFTA, and they think elites are stopping that from happening. So
I mean, I am like to draw up like the feminism stuff a bit here.
Welfare state liberalism.
It's,
you know?
I mean,
it's so hot.
This poll confirms every single one of my priors. And isn't that amazing? I mean, one thing I think is really interesting is there's so much negativity around the term feminism. There's countless, you know, articles and think pieces and whatever about how, you know, young people aren't feminist anymore and like feminism's a dirty word and like everyone's returning to tradition, etc. Our poll finds, we ask people, and we really, you know, what I try to do is like really give people out so that like we're not artificially constraining them to like views that I would find comfortable. We asked, which of the following, if any, do you believe describes feminism in practice? Please select all that apply. So they were able to select multiple of these answers. 64% believe just like straightforward egalitarianism. They believe that feminism is the belief that men and women should be social, political, and economic equals. We also gave them the option to say the belief that women are superior to men, the belief that men stand in the way of women's progress, the belief that women should have more power or status than men. And like very, very tiny minorities selected that answer. Even when you look at Trump supporters, 51%, a majority of Trump supporters believe that feminism is the belief that men and women should be social, political, and economic equals. And I just like, I find this to be, I think, a narrative violation within the takes community. Because I do think there's like this broader, like building idea that like straightforward anti-egalitarianism is popular. Now, again, like, what does that mean in practice is a whole other question. I actually think we did a gender poll earlier in this year in February. And one thing you saw in there time and again is that men have are more likely to believe that women have already achieved equality at our current state, like that they're paid similar amounts for similar work. They're more likely to believe that women are treated fairly in the workplace, et cetera. And women will say like, no, that's not true. But like, I think it's like a huge win that at least the basic proposition that like men and women should be treated equally in our society is like just taken, and that like the dispute is over like empirical questions over whether or not that's happening. And like, I'm not discounting like the importance of those empirical questions. Like if you decide that like equal pay is done and that like women are already equal, you don't have to do anything about social policy to improve childcare or whatever. Like that's like has massive implications for people. But I do think that like many people are very concerned about whether the intent behind most Americans, especially on the right, is actually egalitarian. And like this poll says, and many other polls indicate recently that like, yes, it is.
I guess I found this less... I don't know.
It's affirming, Matthew.
No. I mean, just like everybody's in a different corner of the discourse. Mm-hmm. I was not familiar with the idea that there has been a large scale turn against feminism.
Wow.
I don't know.
You haven't seen these Andrew Tate takes about how all young men are becoming horrible and enamored of like traditional values, quote unquote, that relegate women away from the workplace?
I mean, what I have seen is that, you know, people talk about the growing gender gap in political ideology between young men and young women, and that some people sort of tut-tut this about the right-wing radicalization of young men, but that if you look at the charts, it's more the opposite, and that young women have become more left-wing, and that young men are moderately conservative, as are older men. And so... You know, I mean, like, there was a Pew poll in 2020 and 61% of women said the term feminism describes them either very or somewhat well. Mm-hmm. And but somewhat, like, wildly overperformed very.
Yeah.
and at least, like, that's just sort of like my sense of where things are, that, like, most people, women at least, have like a small amount of discomfort with the concept of feminism, you know? And so then, like, when you ask like a binary question.
Well, it wasn't a binary.
No, I know. I'm saying when you do it, there's other polls that do it as a binary. And it's like, and it depends like a lot on how you phrase it then, right? So it's like, there's an Ipsos poll where they say, do you consider yourself to be a feminist?
Yeah.
And like, that gets like a very low result. But like the, does it describe you well, like does way better, right? Because, you know, there's a duality between sort of like, do you agree with the cause?
Yeah.
And do you like identify with an activist community, right?
Yeah.
It seems to do way less well on that level, that like the people who are doing like the feminism content all the time, not everyone is like, yes, like I want that. But you know, as like all basic, should there be equal rights, blah, 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 like all that stuff pulls really well.
We should be happy about that. I think that's like very good. What I'll say too is like, what I think is really interesting in our poll is that this is a case where people themselves, when asked to answer how they think feminism in practice actually is, hold very egalitarian views. So that's about 64% hold that egalitarian view. But then when asked about the majority of Americans, right, like how do you think the majority of Americans would describe feminism in practice? That number drops to 48. It's still the biggest one, but many more people believe that their fellow countrymen have more negative views in how I would describe negative views of feminism, right? So like, and it really goes mostly towards the belief that men stand in the way of women's progress and the belief that women should have more power or status than men. The plurality still think the majority of Americans are egalitarians here. And I think that like that is like really notable and like kind of comports a lot with what you were just saying, Matt, around how people are willing to self-describe. Because like, you know, if you think you're a feminist, right, but like you think most Americans misunderstand that word to mean something negative, like you're just not going to use that word to describe yourself. And like, it's just like, I find this to be a, like how often people are doing 3D chess to be one of the more like irritating parts of like political analysis. And I remember there was all of this discourse around whether or not like a woman could ever win the presidency. And like, you know, you and I have both written about this and talked about this a lot, about like how you see over and over again that women do not underperform men. But what you've now begun to see in Democratic primaries is the perception of women's unelectability makes it difficult for women to win a Democratic primary, even though Democratic primary voters themselves do not view it to be a hindrance.
Right. But I mean, to me, that's also like part of the like duality of this term, right? Because there's like a certain mode in which people are asking me what I think about different things. And I'm like, A, I think men and women should have equal rights.
Yeah.
And like, B, I think that like men and women are equally good as politicians. And like, C, I think that because like most Democrats are women, that like, and also because women are somewhat less scandal prone than men.
Yeah.
Like a meaningful majority of Democratic candidates for office should be women.
Yeah.
And so those are like feminist takes, I would say. But then flip it around. If I'm talking about electability, I would express to you a fair amount of annoyance at how feminists have constructed this whole space, in which like my understanding of the discourse is that like the correct feminist view to take is that like Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris face this like crippling misogynistic opposite, you know, like I am annoyed by the way I have seen self-anointed feminists, by the way Rebecca Traister characterizes the gender dynamics around electoral politics. And to me, like, she owns that brand much more than I do of, like, who are the feminists.
Maybe you should call yourself a feminist more, Matt. Maybe
I mean, I'm happy to. I mean, yeah, you know, it's like labels are what they are. But, you know, it's, so it's just like, depending on which particular way we pachinko this conversation, I could either be like, I am the truest feminist of all, who's like out here telling you, like, nominate women, be fearless, like, go get them, girl bosses. Or it could be the thing where I'm like, there's this, like, feminist discourse out here where all bad things that happen to women politicians is attributed to sexism, because the, like, feminist thing to do is to, like, wokely raise consciousness. And, like, I think this is backfiring on us and it's really, really bad. And, you know, I don't know, like, you know, the larger community of language users is going to have to decide, like, which word applies best.
Well, no, I mean, I just think that, like, yeah, like, feminist is a big tent and always has had massive disagreements underneath it. And you're right that one strain of feminism has been focused on the true barriers that women face to holding elected office. And I think that, like, has over-indexed on that as a reason why women have not succeeded. Well, specific women, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, did not succeed in their bids to become president of the United States. And then, like, that is harmful, because, like, now you are inculcating this idea in the public that, like, women cannot lead, they should not run, we should not elect them, that they are not going to win. And, like, that is, like, a self-fulfilling prophecy that you're now creating. I mean, this, like, raises kind of, like, broader, like, questions to me. Like, I think about this a lot. Like, a lot of awareness can sometimes come at the expense of the efficacy of your movement. I think this is true at, like, a personal level. Like, sometimes it is, like, accurate, right? To, like, I remember, you know, when I was in college and, you know, the Me Too movement was really starting up, and you are being given new frames to understand interactions you are having with men. And, like, we can, like, debate the accuracy of those. I think that, like, sometimes the frames are, like, completely accurate. Like, okay, like, that was an instance of either, like, you know, someone being coercive to you or treating you badly because of your gender or whatever. But then, like, what does that actually do to you as a political actor? Like, now that you've, like, interpreted, and for me personally, it's, like, I was interpreting all of these experiences negatively, and then it was, like, making me, like, worse at, like, living life. I was like, wow, this is, like, really making me feel bad about the world, about men in general, about the ability for us to, like, coexist in society. And that's, like, a tension, right? Because, like, I still believe those frames have a lot of, like, descriptive value, like, are telling you something true about the world. And also they're, like, making it harder to, like, achieve feminism's goals, which are for women to make decisions for themselves free from manipulation and coercion, for men and women to live freely together and, like, have, like, good relationships and, like, be friends and not be treated differently because of their gender unfairly. And I mean, like, that is, I think, a very, very difficult thing to unknot for a political movement.
Well, and I also think, I mean, I think there's some very specific, this is, we're wandering off topic, but
is that the point of the podcast, or is that
as a Jewish person,
yeah,
who is concerned with the, I think, quite real, incredibly sharp rise in anti-Semitism in America?
Yeah,
I am annoyed by how invested the, like, anti-Semitism lobby,
yeah,
continues to be in. Is they put it, I mean, I wrote a piece about this, but, like, Jonathan Greenblatt was talking, like, we've got to call out this anti-Semitism everywhere we find it.
Yeah.
And that is a technique that the ADL learned on the situation of a generation ago, when, in fact, the level of anti-Semitism in America was incredibly low. Right. Yeah. Like, in a world where there are very low levels of anti-Semitism, finding every borderline case you possibly can and, like, calling it out is, like, a, it's, like, a good way of shutting people down and,
yeah,
shaming them, right? But, like, you know, if you think about my grandparents' experience or the civil rights movement in its, like, peak era, just going, like, yo, that's racist in a deeply racist society doesn't accomplish anything. You know, it's like the proponents of Jim Crow were aware that it was racist.
Well, okay, I don't want to go too far. It's not that it doesn't accomplish. I mean, like, I think that, like, we can all overstate this. Like, the awareness is sometimes necessary to produce the conditions for change. Like, realizing that, like, hey, like, these kinds of interactions are not just the way life is or a necessary function of, like, biologically determined better races getting to lord it over, like, lower. I mean, that was, like, important to frame this as different. Like, there was a genuine belief for a long time of, like, the inferiority. I mean, you know this, but, like, the inferiority of Black Americans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But so now I'm looping it back to, like, celebrities as elites, right? You know, I mean, I watched In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah.
Last year, you know, it's an old movie from the 60s, very clunky by today's storytelling standards. But, like, clearly part of what they are doing in this movie, right, is Sidney Poitier, like, wants to change how people perceive African Americans.
Yeah.
Right. He doesn't want to, like, I'm sure in his heart, he wanted to just yell at racists and how they should be less racist. But, like, because he perceived America in the mid-20th century to be, like, genuinely quite suffused with racism.
Yeah.
He wanted to, like, not just, like, complain, right? But, like, he wanted to change people's minds. So he participated in these films that are this, like, very mannered kind of, like, see?
Yeah.
You know, sort of thing, right? And so, like, both In the Heat of the Night is, like, simultaneously trying to tell Northern white people who perceive themselves as not being racists that, like, the South is worse than they think.
Yeah.
Right? That these really cartoonish racists hold all kinds of social and political power in the American South. But he's also just trying to show audiences, like, look, like, here is a Black guy who speaks this very, you know, standard American diction, who has a lot of self-control and self-composure, who's, like, trying to do the right thing all the time, who is annoyed by these racists and it wounds his pride, but, like, also he's keeping his shit together. You know, and it's like, today you wouldn't do that as a movie.
I don't know. Green Book wanna
well, but,
won an Oscar.
No, but that's the point. Like Green Book is, like, several clicks away from this. But yes, it is in that tradition.
Yeah.
And I think is an example of the ongoing, you know, way in which people who participate in the cultural industry have this disproportionate influence over the trajectory of American society. And to be clear, like, I think mostly for the better. But conservatives are correct to identify that this domination of cultural production by people who don't agree with them, especially about gender issues, is, like, a big deal in American society, that it really is those kind of spaces that in the past, I think, drove changed opinion on race, who in the more recent past really drove changed opinion on gay rights issues, and who continue to be, I think, like, a bulwark of at least, like, light feminism. Like, you, I guess, could disparage America Ferrera as, like, a little thinned out.
I'm not disparaging America Ferrera.
Okay.
America Ferrera's monologue in Barbie, I think, was, like, really impactful for a lot of people, as meaningful. It was like a straightforward example of, a certain type of feminist thinking. But what I'm pointing out is that I viewed it more as a reflection of where the culture had already gone than, like, actually pushing the culture somewhere new. Like, that sort of feminism, I think, had already suffused. And so this perception that these celebrities have this extreme power to push culture in a specific direction, I think, is from an older era where the ability to be an author online, a producer of content, whatever, was actually really winnowed down to just a few people. And, like, in modern day, I don't actually view celebrities as pushing the culture forward that much. Like, they often just come in at the tail end of things that are already happening in society, particularly when it becomes popular. Green Book to me is, like, a reflection of where people were. So is Barbie. Like, it wasn't something new.
I mean, that's interesting. Like, I think that's correct about Green Book, and that I think the anti-Green Book takes from the left were over the top.
I'm gonna be honest, I only see one clip of this movie. I actually have not watched.
Okay.
Have you seen this film?
I think it's a pretty good movie.
Okay.
But it is true that there was something a little self-congratulatory about it.
Yeah.
Like, you're sitting here in the 2010s being like, Jim Crow was bad. Like, mm-hmm. Okay, you know, which is different.
Jim Crow was bad, Matt.
Yeah, but I mean, it's different from Poitier and Jewison taking it on at a time when this, like, matters.
Yeah.
As an issue. But I think that the Barbie example is actually closer to the real influence, which is that, like, yes, that's all, like, quite far from the cutting edge, you know, and it's, like, stuff that people who read had, like, all heard a million times before, but that cementing those kinds of ideas in very mainstream pop culture is important because it sets the baseline for the next generation of people. Like, ideas they don't even have to read about because they just see it in movies and TV shows when they're growing up. Now, I agree with you. We're seeing, like, a fragmentation of, like, the cultural production space.
Yeah.
You said about this, right? Like, there's this kind of, like, edgy right-wing anti-feminist discourse that right now has, like, a good amount of traction online. Mm-hmm. So that if you are, like, a very online person, you're supposed to know what we're talking about there. And you can see that it has secured very little traction with the mass public. Mm-hmm. But it has enough traction that if Hollywood were different from how it is, like, you could imagine starting to do, like, mainstream mass culture products mm-hmm. that are based on these ideas. And, like, people mostly just don't do it, you know, because, like, the people who agree with that stuff don't have the right kind of creative skills and social capital to make it. Although we did just see Citizen Vigilante come out, you know, which is not about gender, but about immigration. You know about this movie?
Oh, this is the Armie Hammer one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My friend live texted it to me, so I didn't have to watch it personally. Quite insane. Can you, like, it's like it, this guy is, like, just hunting immigrants in, what is he, in Belgium? Where is he?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that, like, Europe can no longer defend itself against immigrant criminals. And we need a vigilante to save the West.
It's in an unnamed European city. It's bizarre. It's a very bizarre film. Armie Hammer, I think most recently famous for his weird potential cannibalism views, has now been relegated to doing this kind of Elon Musk fan fiction.
I mean, it's a strange movie, but it again, like, I it
did you
very-
watch it?
I watched select scenes, but it just, like, in a very obvious, like, way connects to what is, like, the growing political trend in Europe, you know, which is a belief that the superstructures of European Union law are making it impossible for the voters to get the kinds of anti-immigration policies that they want. You know, I mean,
well, if we go down an immigration rabbit hole, this would be another hour. But I want to return to a different poll, poll result that I thought was super interesting, which is around career success. Matt, maybe you don't remember the results. So I'm going to ask it to you and see what you think. If you had to choose which is more important to you and which is, do you think is most important to the majority of Americans, career success or getting married and having children?
Well, as a successful person in my career who's married and has children, I of course think that my family is more important than my. This one just strikes me as, like, such a social desirability bias.
I agree, but, like, what do you think that people thought about the majority of Americans?
I think that most Americans say that family and children are more important, but that younger people say that career is more important.
No, most Americans are weirdly think that, like, have really high rates of assuming that men in particular think that career success is more important, even as, like, men self-reported is like, no, I think getting married and having children is uh-huh. is more important. So 41% of men said career success, but they thought 67% of men, they assumed, actually care about careers more than having kids. For women, it's like similar trend, but much lower difference.
But what do women think? What's more important to women?
What's more important to women is getting married and having children too. Both of them think getting married and having children is more important, but they assume that career success is more important to the majority of Americans. Yeah.
Do we have age splits on this?
We do.
Because that's what I'd seen in some other surveys, is that the youngest cohorts have just become, like, way more amoral and materialistic. And I think that's bad as a middle-aged father. Your podcast friend from work is not going to be there for you on your deathbed.
No, this is interesting. So this is interesting. So basically, I mean, it's similar to what you're saying. 57% of 18 to 29 year olds say that career success is more important to them. That's the highest.
Right.
The next highest, millennials, 44% will say career success, 39% of Gen Xers, 32% of 65 plus. And so like in that case, like they are they are reporting their own preference here. But for that same age group, when asked about the majority of American women, 18, 29 year olds say only 41% say career success. So like they are the least likely to say that women care about career success more than getting married and having children. And then when asked about men, they are also the least likely to say that career success is more important than getting married and having children, which I find like super weird.
That's odd. That's a little hard to make sense of. Yeah. But I was right though. There is an age gradient where younger people are more likely to say that careers are
important. But that's also just to me, like, I mean, people always say sometimes like, yeah, like, I think between the ages of like 18 to 27 or whatever, believing that career success is the most important thing is like quite normal because people have like pushed off the age at which they get married and have children. So my question is more like a cohort thing. Like these 18, 29 year olds, will their opinions shift when they are 30 to 44 or will they maintain their materialist views? Like how much, you know what I mean? Like that to me is like...
It's also very reasonable to think if you're 21.
Yeah.
And you want to get married and have children, that like getting a foothold into a successful career is like a good part of achieving that goal versus like, what are you going to do?
Get married immediately.
Right. I mean, maybe, you know, so I just say like, I guess I disagree with you that like one question is have people like actually had like a transfiguration of values.
Yeah.
And another is like, have younger people, have younger cohorts altered their understanding of like life sequencing events, right?
Yeah.
You talk to conservatives, right? And they're like, they're really into the like success sequence for avoiding poverty, where you're supposed to graduate from high school, get a full-time job, be married, and then have kids, and you'll avoid poverty. Mm-hmm. So they're like big proponents of that. But then they get really upset if people add like a little bit more to the success sequence. Then they're like, no, you're doing it wrong. It's like, you have to graduate high school, get a full-time job, and then as soon as you've done that, get married, right? And
but
it's not, like,
but conservative elites, though, for them, it's fine to wait until you're
It's hard to know. You know, it's just, it's like, it's very, you know, an unfortunate reality of human life is that these like age tipping points, like do sneak up on you.
Yeah.
Kind of like, faster than one would like. And that's just, I mean, that's true of like fertility, but it's also just true of like, how do my knees feel on any given day?
Yeah.
You know, you like wake up one day and you're like, oh shit, I got old. And it was faster than I thought it would. And so I actually do like agree with the take that everyone should maybe be like in a little bit more of a rush than they want to. But I also understand that that's not, you know, while you're going through it, everyone's like, well, like what's like right in front of me right now? And it's like, well, I could get a job. I could get a promotion. I could get a better job, right? These things seem way more actionable.
Yeah.
Particularly when you're younger, and your timeline for like career advancement slows down as you become old. Like, even if you're still ambitious, it's like the arc on which you could plausibly get to another level is like slower. And if you have children, they're very important to you, more important to you than the hypothetical children of somebody who like wants to have children.
Yes.
So, you know, I sympathize with everybody's answers to this. So I thought one of the most interesting things here is that I would say that among informed people in America today, there is a big block who is like worried about declining birth rates.
Yeah.
And another big block who's like, this is not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But that both sides agree that like, that is the thing that we are debating because birth rates have gone down a lot.
Yeah.
And that in the past, people argued a lot about overpopulation and there were the overpopulation warriors and there were the calm downers. Mm-hmm. But as the author of 1 Billion Americans, I am well aware that randos on call-in radio shows are still very worried about overpopulation.
Yeah.
And you see that here, that more people are worried about overpopulation than about declining birth rates.
Yeah.
And they are more likely to see that as a concern of a majority of people, and they're more likely to see it as an elite concern. So
to
in
be clear,
this case,
these numbers are pretty big. So 50% of people will say that overpopulation is a big problem, and 43% say that declining birth rates are a big problem. So like the really big difference is in strongly agree. So it's not like a massive difference, but you do see, you know.
But I think there's a huge elite misperception around this, right? Yes. So like Claudia Golden, the economist who's done work on gender, I think not specifically on fertility, but, you know, a lot of adjacent work. And she's very famous, you know.
Nobel Prize winning.
She's, you know, sort of a celebrity, I think sort of an elite. you know, she there was this Bloomberg article where she was like, there's all these like dud men out there. That's why people aren't having kids anymore. And then certain social conservatives got very angry at her. Some other social conservatives were like, eh, she's probably onto something. And I thought like all participants in this discourse were like missing the fact that there's these like contrasting left and right like diagnoses of why this is happening.
Yeah.
But like actually most people just don't agree that it's a problem. And then like a very large number of people are worried about overpopulation. And so you're, of course, not going to reach any kind of cultural or political or policy or anything consensus about like changes to address the problem of falling fertility.
Yeah.
Where people don't think it's a problem. And in fact, people think overpopulation is a big problem. And I also think this is like a, you know, Pedro Sanchez, the prime minister of Spain, who's probably the last really pro-immigration politician standing in the democratic world.
We stand.
He is talking about like in this world of declining population and falling fertility, like we need immigrants to keep the economy going. And again, I don't have a poll of Spanish opinion, but it's like there are just like premises operating there that people don't agree with.
Well, Well,
then at least Americans don't agree.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And in America, where we have
the argument,
American population. Politics is like turned anti-immigrant, while the Spanish has turned pro-immigrant. But America is like still has a lot of immigrants here, and you know, if you think the country is overpopulated, that's of course going to lead you to certain kinds of preconceptions about policy that are different from if you're like, there's a lot of space here.
So tabling the immigration, because I think the one thing I'll say here is that when you look at people who say that overpopulation is a big problem, the Harris voters are much more likely to say this than the Trump, or reasonably more likely to say this than the Trump voters, which indicates to me this is actually much more downstream of like the environmentalist sort of anti-growth thing than the like immigration thing. And I will say too, like it's possible, I mean, a lot of people, when I hear them complain about overpopulation, it's often in a very like NIMBY context. So they're not like thinking about like even like the Paul Ehrlich like global sense of like environment. They're like looking around Berkeley and going, there's a lot of traffic. I'm really annoyed that when I look around, there's too many people. Like there's that famous like, you know, popular office meme of like Dwight saying we need a new plague as he looks out at a crowd of people, which is like a popular joke that gets resurfaced a lot because people are annoyed about crowding rather than often like the specific numbers of people. And I think that like it's possible to be like, okay, yeah, overpopulation is a big problem and also declining birth rates are a big problem. So we looked at this and we wanted to see like the number of people that agree with this. 37% of people said that both declining birth rates and overpopulation are a big problem. I've like sane washed this a little bit for you, but I just do think that's kind of funny.
Well, yes. But I mean, to your point though, earlier, you know, I think that there is a real incoherence in how progressive America thinks about the intersection between immigration, population, environment, growth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That like the typical, you know, like progressive policy paradigm is that it's bad when poor countries become less poor, because that is pushing the world closer to an ecological tipping point, right? So like they will, you know, again, they won't say it that way, right?
Yeah, but
like,
they certainly will not.
No, but I mean,
way.
But you show them a chart of global carbon dioxide emissions over the past 20 years. And they're like, this is the worst thing that has happened in human history, right? And it is just a chart of economic growth. And then they're like totally against, skeptical of immigration enforcement, but also completely hostile to housing construction, right? And to the extent that they favor housing construction at all, they want it to be like this public housing that people are going to have to queue for. They want rent control to protect incumbent renters. Much more enthusiasm about that than anything that could help newcomers and stuff go. So it's this like logical infrastructure of anti-immigration politics. But then like they are aware, they've like heard the good news that like diversity and immigration and stuff are all good. But in a practical level, like the policy paradigm of New York State is like very hostile to newcomers.
Yeah.
And all of the like progressive ideas that are gaining traction are like more hostile.
Yeah, I wrote an article about this like a few years ago for The Atlantic, which we'll put in show notes. People underrate how much the modern, virulently anti-immigration groups are literally descendants of the zero population growth environmentalist movement. There are people who are advocating for downzoning major American cities as part of environmentalist degrowth movements who these groups then like graduated into becoming virulently anti-immigrants. Like they took the logic of that like quite seriously. They were like, yeah, like it is bad when new people come here and ruin things. I don't like new people. Therefore, we should expand that version of not liking new people to the whole world. Sometimes I will hear like left NIMBYs get really upset at like YIMBYs for saying that like, you know, they are essentially doing anti-immigration politics at a local level when they oppose the construction of new housing. But like the very people who are involved in anti-immigration politics today are the descendants of the same groups that were doing zero population growth environmentalism in the previous generation. So like this is something that incenses me constantly. I find this to be like so frustrating.
But it's not just this, right? Like, because like at the Sierra Club, and NRGC and all these organizations,
yeah,
like they've gotten the memo that that's bad.
Well, not Center for Biological Diversity, which sure is still doing condoms to reduce the birth rate.
Well, no. But that's actually what I mean. Like all these groups, like they do the progressive coalition politics. They like heard that they're not supposed to be anti-immigration anymore. And so they're not. Right.
Yeah.
But there is no state in America that has adopted a carbon dioxide emissions target that is specified in per capita terms.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There are states with no target, and there are states with targets that are population indifferent.
Yeah.
So, like, the actual will of the environmental movement is to crush in-migration.
Yes.
Like, where they exert political power, they attempt to put, and it's like, you see it, right? It's like, the closer you get to, like, what do they, because, like, what policy do they actually have control over? And it's like, the governor of Connecticut wants to be good on climate. And, like, so what do the climate groups want him to do? They want him to have an emissions target.
Yeah.
What kind of emissions target do they want to have? Well, they want it to be more aggressive rather than less aggressive. And do they want it to be specified in per capita or in aggregate terms? And they always say aggregate, right?
Yes.
So like the deep logic of anti-immigration remains like at the core of what they're doing. And I think it's why Harris voters are more likely to express anxiety about overpopulation, even though, like, if you flip it around differently, obviously Harris voters are much friendlier to immigration and all this other kind of stuff. But it's like they've heard from the Greens that like overpopulation is a big problem.
And I think it's underrated to me, too. Like, obviously, like lots of things go into creating anti-immigration sentiment in this country. But I think it is incredibly underrated still to this day how creating a scarcity of housing has fueled anti-immigration politics. Like, I will say this till I am blue in the face. One of the closing messages that J.D. Vance was making in the 2024 campaign was about how home prices were rising because of immigrants.
Right.
And one thing that's very, very difficult is that, like, of course, everyone knows, like, supply and demand function. If you don't build more housing and then there's a bunch of new demand, like, yes, like, functionally that has upward pressure on prices, even though, you know, specifically with immigrants, there's like the countervailing pressure of immigrant populations constructing a bunch of housing, being a part of the construction workforce. But like, it is very difficult to like have a sense of like wanting to be open to the world and also having this like very sort of like Jeffersonian like localist view that like the existing local community is supposed to be the legitimate one and newcomers are less legitimate. Like it is very difficult to actually square this in a way that is going to produce good politics. And what it does produce, like as you were saying, is a politics that is anti-growth, anti-housing, and even if in rhetoric is pro-immigrant, is hostile to immigrants. Like it is very, very difficult for immigrants to just like move into cities and societies where there is not cheap, readily available housing for them to take advantage of. And it creates these horrible dynamics with existing low-income residents, as we saw in Chicago, when instead of resolving kind of like these bigger concerns, you end up diverting fiscal resources to newcomers at the expense of at the perceived expense of old hats. So I think there's like a level here which both of us are small L liberals here. You could be able to just embrace the light of liberalism and then we'll all be good and we'll have perfect pro-immigration politics forever.
Well, can I say, so here we should close this out, but like,
yeah.
I thought the American people's craziest take in this poll is that only 43% of people said that elected officials are elites.
Yeah.
And like, to me, I'm part to the point of what we're just talking about here, right? It's like elected officials are like paradigmatic elites. Like the blue state governors who've been setting these carbon caps, these emissions targets, like they are elite decision makers. They are choosing to not reconcile the conflict between two like competing moments of their commands. They are doing coalition management via incoherence and kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
They could choose differently. Journalists, I think, like ours, at least in like a Hans Noel sense, the other thing that like you and I do, right, is we're like doing these takes and we're trying to say like, guys,
we're coalition merchants.
I understand that you have this log roll where the immigration lawyers and the environmental lawyers are like both have a seat at the table. But like what they are saying is actually in conflict.
Yeah.
And like you need to think about this. And like this is what like elites do.
Yeah.
Right. Because the mass public, God bless, is just like entitled to have these like somewhat superficial understandings of how these ideas fit together. And they'll just affirm different things, you know, like immigrants, we get the job done, you know, climate is an existential threat. And it's like elites need to construct a coherent policy agenda that like weighs these considerations. And like the idea of like a per capita versus an aggregate emissions target is like so fucking boring. Nobody halfway normal is going to care. Like it actually matters quite a lot. And like, this is what like a responsible elite needs to like handle these things better than we currently are.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to do peer review. All right. We're back with peer review. Matt, what do you got for me?
We got a good one. This is we're delving into the truth of the American elite. We are looking at From Field to Firm, College Sports and Early Stage Career Choice by Paul Gompers, George Hu, Will Levinson, and Sachin Srivastava. And so they are looking at sort of hiring networks among Ivy League varsity athletes. The headline finding here is that if you are employing one additional alumni from a specific Ivy League collegiate sports team, so you get like a guy who played baseball at Yale, this increases the odds that another Yale baseball player will join your firm by 193.7%.
It's like an incredible effect.
We have grown accustomed in empirical social science to modest effect sizes being turned into a big deal because people want to get their papers published.
Yeah.
But this is a really big effect size. And then they said they could tamp it down. So any Ivy League athlete who plays the same sport, right? So not just like another guy from Yale baseball, but from any Ivy League baseball team goes up 16.4%.
Yeah.
And then any athlete from the same university goes up 4.6%. So we can see people really like to hire their teammates. They also like to hire guys who they played against. And they have a modest inclination to just hire like other sports bros who they went to school with.
So one thing I'll say is that the 193.7% is obviously a massive effect size. It like sounds larger than I think it practically is because it's a relative increase from like a very small baseline probability. So I think it's not like implausible. I think a couple interesting things that I started thinking about as a result of this paper. One is that like the team connections dwarf like the ordinary alumni connections, or even like the other guys who played sports, the same sport as you at a different school, or other guys who played sports at your school. And I think it like indicates like the network benefits of being in these elite groups is like quite powerful. And I would expect, like, they don't actually show this in the paper, obviously, but like I would expect like other things like eating clubs at Princeton or finals clubs at whatever school does that. I don't remember which one. Is that Harvard thing?
It is.
Finals club. Okay. Finals clubs. You would know, Matthew. Finals clubs. Were you in a finals club or no?
I was not in it. It's a final club.
Finals club.
I was not in a final club. No.
Wow. My apologies. The final clubs at Harvard.
I tried to get into the Signet Society, but I was
Is that a secret society?
It's an arts and culture organization. There is a prominent secret network of Signet Society alumni working.
Is this just euphemistic? This
working in arts and media? No, okay. I don't know. I couldn't get in.
Okay. Well, anyway, I would expect that like other kind of small groups at elite colleges similarly play a really strong role, whether these kinds of things or fraternities or sororities or even like debating societies, like whatever it is. And I mean, I will say this, like one thing that people who are opposed to affirmative action will often say to me is that like I am overrating like how important these access to these institutions actually is in order to achieve kind of broader goals of egalitarianism. And like, this is not a dispositive study in my favor, but what I will say is that like, my perception as someone who did not attend a very elite university is that like, actually, when I am now observing elites that I am like around in DC all the time, they all seem to know each other from like these specific clubs and things, or like from college they all went to together. And like, that clearly has had some sort of benefit to them. And I will just say this, like, if you are someone who is like discounting the importance of affirmative action here, like one channel through which I think that like it's increasingly unlikely for you to be correct is that it just like doesn't matter whether you have more people of color going to these schools in order to shift what the composition of big firms or important companies looks like.
Okay, so I guess like two following points here. One that I think is a little bit in tension with your analysis is that not different, but, you know, one reason that the effect is so large is that clearly, like, actually knowing somebody carries a lot of value, right? And I think one thing about that is that it can lead people to actually overestimate the, like, signaling value of having attended the school, right? So it's like the guy who played with you, like, on your team is like somebody who you know.
Yes.
Right? These schools are fairly large. Like there's a lot of, I went to college with a lot of people who I don't know.
Yeah.
And we sometimes now pretend that we knew each other because we're like working in politics in DC and are roughly the same age. But it's like, it's not true. You know?
Oh, so everyone's messing with me? They don't actually know each other? Is that what you're saying?
It's to an extent, you know? I mean, it's, no, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, like I know Rohit Chopra from American Politics.
Yeah.
And also he lived around the corner from me. And also we went to college at the same time and we did like know some of the same people and stuff. And, you know, I don't know, like that's a, but like I didn't know him in school, you know, like from back there, but we're like part of some nebulous like Harvard mid-aughts blob, you know, along with other people. But it would be interesting to redo this with things that are not sports teams, because your supposition, like if I had to pre-register my study, I think it would come out that way. But like, we don't actually know. The other thing that I thought was, this is just whatever, but, you know, people used to talk about finance bros.
Yeah.
And then that like verbiage, like leapt to people started talking about tech bros. But one thing you can see here is that the athlete alumni network effect is like way prominent in finance, like very specifically in finance. And then it's present, but in an attenuated way in consulting. And it's then present in a more attenuated way in law and in technology. But it's quite attenuated.
Yes.
When you get down there. So there's like a real sense in which there are like finance bros, like guys who played lacrosse in college, are like very prominent in the financial services industry. The tech industry, there's a lot of men working in tech, but I don't know that they're bros.
All men are bros. A brotherhood of equals.
That is not correct. And we see it here, right? It's like,
I was saying that in a beautiful egalitarian way. You are using it pejoratively. I think bros are good.
I love and respect the bros, but it's bros are hiring bros.
That's true.
Like that's what we are seeing here. They are not just randomly hiring other Ivy League graduates. They're hiring their own teammates, but it attenuates to like people who weren't their teammates, but like they like other athletes, right? Because like they themselves, so whether it's true or not, that playing varsity collegiate sports demonstrates important things about character and leadership and discipline, you can understand that the people who played collegiate varsity sports think that that's true. Yeah. They're like, I was up at 5 a.m. rowing a fucking boat while these other losers were sleeping in or hungover or whatever. And so they like, they really respect and value that experience.
Yeah.
And it's similarly, I mean, I think like military veterans, you know, like to hire other veterans. Now, they like to hire people they knew, as do many people, but they like respect the service as a credential in a way that other people might look at and be like, why the fuck were you getting up at 5 a.m. to row a boat? Like, that's stupid.
I respect our troops. What I will say is this. I'm
talking about crew athletes. We all respect the troops.
Okay. I misunderstood. But I will say, this paper does a lot of stuff, so I'm not, you know, criticizing them. But like, I do wish I had like more of a sense of the impact of these hiring decisions on firm quality or even self-reported anything from the firm. Because like, I don't really know what my prior would be about like whether these sorts of networks like improve like the productivity of these companies or whether it like hampers them by reducing diversity of backgrounds that you're getting like different kinds of people and not kind of like replicating the same person over and over again. Seems interesting, seems difficult to know. This is a pretty big sample size, like 170,000 people that they're following over like 50 years. So maybe they can, do some more slices of the data and run some analyses and see, and maybe do some, I don't know, some surveys, but it seems hard because, you know, some of these firms were in the 1950s. So I don't know how you would actually get that information.
Yeah. I mean, it's also worth saying, I mean, they looked specifically at Ivy League colleges.
Yeah.
It might be interesting to see this more broadly.
Fraternities, sororities.
Well, no. So there's like non-sports, but also just like the sports, you know, this is a big athletics program at the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
And some of that is like D1 college football, which is like a eccentric and like a way bigger deal than Ivy League sports, but they also have like lower sports. But it does also, you know, people sometimes wonder about the like recruiting of athletes for these kind of like obscure fancy sports. Mm-hmm. I mean, colleges field basketball and football teams because those sports like bring in, like directly bring in like fans and revenue. You never meet a like college fencing super fan. But like a lot of schools do have these programs. And, you know, one reason for it is that a lot of alumni athletes just like they care a lot about these teams and they donate money and they pay it forward. And you can wonder why that is, but it's like people feel these connections across space and time, and it like manifests in their hiring. It's like not, it might be good, it might be bad, it might be totally irrational, it might be actually like a great way to screen for employees, but it's like, it's not cheap talk. Like people are actually hiring other athletes, primarily not people who were like high-end competitors in the most mainstream sports in America. These are mostly these kind of weird sports. And
yeah. Well, I accidentally hired someone who did college debate, but I did not know this when I actually hired her. So I feel perhaps I'm perpetuating inequality by doing that.
You
so.
Can tell a college debater. From
I did not.
From like
she's
20
European.
Feet away.
It's rude. She's European, so it's very... You know, who knows? All right. Well, this was great. Elites in all forms of this podcast. If you guys like this, please like, subscribe, tell your friends about the podcast, and we'll see you next Thursday.
Bye.